The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world, and we kind of look at the world through the prism of Catholic social values and beliefs. And we kind of call our show Just Love because we kind of believe if you just love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and if all of us did that, our world would be more just and more compassionate. Well, you know, for those Catholics listening to us, which is probably the most of our listeners, this is Lent. If you haven't noticed it, you should have, because they put a lot of those ashes things on people's forehead on Ash Wednesday, and you probably saw people with them. And we're kind of really coming into the home stretch of Lent, and we're getting ready for the Great Holy Week. And so we're going to kind of continue our conversation. And one of the things we've been trying to do during Lent is to kind of figure out where people are in terms of their religious beliefs, their spirituality, and look at very different communities. So today I'm absolutely delighted that we have in the studio here with us Professor Fred Perella. And if in terms of disclaimers, Fred is a friend of mine who I'm privileged to call a friend for decades, and I'm delighted that he's with us. He's a professor of theology in the Department of Religious Studies at Santa Clara University, but he really is a New Yorker, even though he's been out there for, ages upon ages. So I'm delighted that he's going to be with us. We'll go to him in just a few minutes. And then our next next part of the series is part of our what we've been calling Making Lent Great Again 2017. And what we're doing is kind of exploring the different ways that Lent can be great. And one of the things we're going to look at today is how does Lent relate to Ramadan? So our guest is going to be she's not a full professor. She's only an associate professor. Fred's a real big shot. When you get to be big professors, but associate professors is pretty good. They got tenure. And so Dr. Maynaz Afridi is at Manhattan College. Where Manhattan College, by the way, is the place where Tom Dobbins, who is our sidekick here, he graduated from there. And so she's a professor of religious studies this week. Hey, Tom, the guest we have this week, a little bit too holy for our taste.
Yeah.
We got a theologian who does religious studies, and we got another one. I mean, come on.
One's ever called me holy.
Right. Well, you know, so we are. So anyway, so we're delighted that she is going to be with us, and she's the director of, a real heavy center up there, the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center. Those are some very, very serious topics. She herself is a Muslim. And so we're going to look at what the Islamic tradition has to say and teach regarding spiritual practices. And we'll talk a little bit about Lent. And I'm going to try, I'm pretty sure I can, cajole Fred, a professor from Santa Clara. I can cajole him to kind of stay in the studio with us and maybe in his two cents with Professor Maynaz Afridi. So I think we're going to have a good show today, Tom. Tom, thanks for getting the guests that we have there. So, listen, I don't want to waste anybody's time here. So let's go to some talented people. Dr. Fred Perella, who is a professor of theology in the Department of Religious Studies at Santa Clara University. Fred, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kevin, for the invitation. And it's been too long since I've been on.
Well, it is. So you got to come back. And now here's the thing that our listeners want to do. And I'm sorry, listeners, if you're in the middle of the country and you don't really care about the New York City subways, well, you just got to bear with me for a while, because I have on as a guest here somebody who hasn't been in New York for decades, about four decades
right
now, who knows more about the New York City subway system than most of us native New Yorkers. Have you kept up on what happened most recently?
Absolutely, and Fred, I can't wait to see the three new stations.
Okay, well, tell our listeners what just happened.
The new Second Avenue subway line opened at 96th, 86th, and 72nd. And that is the Q train running at the present time.
Yep. See that?
Later will be the T train when it all is finished.
Okay. I told you. And I'm doing a little bragging myself. I got to go on the first ride of that on New Year's Eve, and the first ride was free. So because we were guests of the governor, and he kind of got some people in. So we had a few thousand people who were there, and we got in, beautiful subway. You know, for us who are real New York subway players, yeah, three new stations. Okay, it's a big deal, but you know, we got like thousands of stations in the whole. We may not have a thousand, but we got hundreds of different stations throughout. Do you know how many stations, Fred?
I don't know exactly.
Come on, make it up. Nobody else is going to.
411.
I think
know.
That's right. Well, plus these three, it makes it 414.
14. You got
right,
it.
Right. Okay, I got it. So, Fred, so let's go. Let's talk to our what we're going to talk about today, a little bit of spirituality. And so I want to talk about the fact that, you know, an old guy like me wants to know what are. What's going on our college campuses? I mean, you know, we can look at the statistics, and just from our Catholic point of view, we know that I think now the recent Pew study said maybe 24-25% of Catholics regularly go to Mass. We also know from the Pew studies that that ex-Catholics are a very, very high percentage of people. We also know that this category, which I think I want to spend some time talking with you about, is I think they're called nuns, aren't they?
Right.
What's that stand for?
They have no affiliation whatsoever.
But they're spiritual.
They claim to be spiritual, right, even though they certainly have nothing to do with religion.
Okay.
In an institutional
way. So, Fred, give us a little bit of your take on what's going on. And let me ask you the question this way. So we talked about nuns, spiritual. So to put in my phrase, the students who you teach at Santa Clara University, which is a very, very fine university, you know, what, maybe 70, 80 miles south of San Francisco in San Jose?
Yeah, 45.
Okay. Yeah. But it feels like 80 when you're on the roads there.
right in the heart of Silicon Valley.
So it's Lent. What's going on the campus? Anybody know it's Lent?
Yes. we do have some special ceremonies and services. There were services on Ash Wednesday. They will have a very lovely Holy Week. They will be, one of the services will be ecumenical. We have our, one of our campus ministers represents Protestantism. And, of course, we have a Jewish rabbi who also participates. We have a Muslim as part of campus ministry now, since we have lots of Near Eastern students who are Muslim.
So, okay, Ash Wednesday is one of those days which Catholics who, you know, may not be regular attenders at church on Sunday, you probably get a good turnout on most places for Ash Wednesday. Many of the students go, and did they receive ashes on Ash Wednesday?
Yes, a great number of them did. And some of them who did went with Catholic friends and probably haven't been inside of a church in years, or their parents don't practice, but they went up and got ashes too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, how would you describe the faith, the spirituality, the religion of the students? And obviously there are thousands of students, you teach hundreds of students, you know, you can't generalize because all of us are individuals, but you know, you probably pick up some patterns.
I pick up a lot of patterns, and the one that I find most disturbing presently is that the students are under a great deal of pressure to achieve. And in many ways, one student just recently told me, I don't have time for religion anymore. I have to get ahead. The pattern I find disturbing is that people from traditional Catholic families two generations ago, that would be our generation when we were in college, their parents may have given up tradition, and even though they have very traditional Catholic names, ethnic Catholic names, they have no contact with church or religion at all. They know nothing. They put down religion, none. And I find that disturbing, that the tradition is dying among these people, because their children, when they get married in 5 or 10 years, will have even less a relationship.
You know, Fred, to use that example, we're speaking with Dr. Fred Perella, who is a full professor of religious studies at the University of Santa Clara in Santa Clara, California. You know, Fred, I know also you being kind of a still New Yorker, but one of the great hobbies that people have is looking at the style wedding pages in the Sunday New York Times. And what you just pointed out is something that a previous pastor of mine who used to read that diligently there would point out, the number of traditionally Catholic sounding names, whether they be Irish or be they Italian, whose weddings were nowhere in a church, and the presider at the wedding was not a minister or certainly not a Catholic priest, that it was rare. If you maybe had 10 or 15 weddings that were being recorded there, maybe one, two of them happened in a Catholic church.
And that's absolutely right. In this narrow niche of middle class to well-educated Americans, religion is truly dying. And they will say,
"Hey, Fred, well, you've been teaching this for a while. Is it your fault?"
I sometimes wonder. I do teach the two popular classes are theology of marriage, which of course takes in a lot of other issues besides just theology, and theology of death. So they're existential classes.
Yeah, well, I could tell you, you know, marriage you're not doing too well, but death, still everybody's doing that.
Everybody's doing it, and I even have to say, even if you don't marry, you're going to die. But a lot of people commit themselves to living with one person monogamously, even though they don't even go through ceremonies.
Right.
Or at best, they'll run down to City Hall.
So let's talk positively for for a moment. And I think it's right to point out some of the things that happened. But, you know, what I read about millennials and whatever is, okay, maybe they don't want to talk of themselves as religious. Maybe they're not. But I hear there is talk of spirituality, and spirituality is a good thing.
Yes, it is. And many of them are deeply concerned about one another. They watch out for one another, as highly individualistic as they are. When they work together, they stay in touch with one another. And there is a sense of responsibility for the other. And I think that's a very positive sign.
So tell me a little bit about that. To get very kind of concrete and practical, obviously, I think, you know, people may watch out for each other when they're on dates or stuff like that. But you're telling me stuff goes beyond that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And especially when they get into senior year and they start making plans, they help each other along. They will often take a position because one of their friends is working for the same accounting company or engineering company. And of course, at the heart of Silicon Valley, there are many jobs in those areas. And there's a kind of concern for the welfare of one another. That is a very positive sign that I see in the millennials. And in what some are calling post-millennials, I just think they're millennials a little bit younger. There are positive signs there.
That's very interesting that there is that sense of concern, connection. Now, again, let me push you a little bit on that one. Everybody kind of wants a friend, people don't like to be alone or lonely. Does it go beyond just, I want somebody to be with, or is it?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
And I think, you know, many of the students fall into two patterns in terms of relationships. One is that they're part of the hookup culture.
Okay.
So they have, sex is always presumed, but they have no commitment. In response to that, we have another group of people who overcommit to a partner in what is called the romantic solution. And this partner becomes almost a god in the other person's life. Many fellow students will help rescue both of these groups, saying, you know, hooking up will get you nowhere. You've turned this person into a god or goddess. No gender differences there. Are you sure you're doing the right thing? So there is that deeper concern about relationships. And about, I'd say about a quarter of our students have never been in or have no intention of being in a serious relationship in college.
Huh. You know, one of the other criteria that some colleges use for concern, which is not the interpersonal that you're talking about, but they'll kind of sometimes measure the number of volunteer hours or volunteering both while they're in college and also then, you know, some universities pride themselves on a year of volunteer service after that. What's your observation about those things?
Santa Clara has a very high number of students who participate in the greater Jesuit commitment to social justice and a just society. So many, many people will do volunteer work during their academic years, and many will also go into Jesuit Volunteer Corps, into Franciscan and other religious communities where they can be of service. And that is remarkable, I think, that they will give up what I see as giving up a couple of years of their lives to be of help to others, to work in soup kitchens, to take care of homeless people.
You know, Fred, it's interesting because to some extent, it runs against another theme, which you mentioned before, that, well, I don't have time for religion because I have to succeed. I don't have time for this because I got to get ahead. Well, this is almost a little bit counter that motif.
It appears to be, but I think they see this as much closer to their spirituality and their spiritual destinies. What they don't want is organized religion. They don't want being told what to do. I find a statistic that's, and I use this in the marriage class, 98% of Americans who do not want children practice artificial contraception. That number is still 98% of American Catholics. So they just don't want to follow what they're told to do. Right. And that says a great deal. But they still are committed and want to help others, especially one another, and especially those people who in the Jesuit tradition have unlocked doors where they're needed, who will travel abroad and other programs too, which is impressive.
We're speaking with Dr. Fred Perella, who is a professor of theology in the Department of Religious Studies at Santa Clara University. And as we're in Lent, we're speaking a little bit about the spirituality of college students, particularly the students that he teaches. He teaches courses on marriage and death, and so has a pretty good insight into, you know, those who come into his classroom and from the discussions that go on there. Fred, I want to ask you a question about kind of service, caring for, you know, for each other. Where does sacrifice fit in?
That's a wonderful question, Kevin. And one of the things that I emphasize very strongly in both the classes in marriage and death is that love is sacrifice. It means I must give up my self-importance, my ego-centeredness. It doesn't mean I don't have a strong psychological ego. It doesn't, because Jesus and the Buddha and Muhammad certainly did. But it means that I cannot be the center of the universe. I have to see myself as part of a whole. And even students who say, I don't believe in God, are forced out of their own self-seclusion, are forced to see that they are sacrificing when they give up a year to the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. They are sacrificing when they're helping a student who isn't as good in writing or reading and so forth.
I hear what you're saying. I agree with you completely. And yet, the charge by some of us older guys against the millennials is it's all about me.
Yes, and I think there's that strange contradiction.
Okay.
It does. They're overwhelmed by what is demanded of them individually. The number of unfortunate, tragic suicide rates among college students seems to be ever increasing. They are very much dependent on their parents that the Gen X's were not. They still go home to mommy and daddy, and mommy and daddy keep an eye on them. I don't know why. The culture has taken a terrible toll on the millennials and those that are following them. And I think we all went through struggle and toll, but it's different now. And I think it's far more dangerous for many of these people. They need much more than we needed, and they're searching for it.
Well, you know, Fred, I might just offer my own opinion, and obviously this is a little bit self-serving given the business that I'm in. But I wonder if there isn't a connection that kind of, and I'm just going to tease out this as my hypothesis, since our listeners, when you got somebody smart in the studio, you might as well try out some new ideas, and you find out when they're dumb and you get told about them. I'm going to try a hypothesis that is maybe you can do spirituality on your own, but you can't do religion on your own. And so that what religion gives you is a little bit of a buffer or a little bit of a structure where you don't have to figure it all out for yourself. And it's not only about your parents, but there's kind of, you got a few years of history that you can draw from. You got a little bit of room where you can operate within, but you're not out there naked against the world. Spirituality, you kind of figure most of it out for yourself. And if you're feeling a little bit weak at times, maybe the outside comes in at you. I'm throwing that idea out.
That's a wonderful insight. And Lutheran theologian Paul Tillich, who died in 1965.
By the way, listeners, Fred plugs Tillich every place he can get because he's written books on Tillich. He gives lectures on Tillich. So that wasn't just a throwaway line. He's plugging Tillich as his guy.
Yes, his books are still available. He said that religion and spirituality were interchangeable. And I think he has a very important insight. All spirituality is ecclesial, has something to do with community, with church. Unfortunately, those connections are just not clear.
Can I just
sure.
interrupt?
Yeah.
All spiritually should be.
Should be. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And so the question is, they pick other communities to support them.
Right.
I think it's entirely possible that what we call organized religion will make a great comeback generations from now. Or as our former bishop in San Jose said so beautifully, he said, "I represent organized religion. There is no such thing. It's all disorganized. I do the best I can."
Well, you know, Fred, I'll tell you, what was it, Tom? 2 weeks ago we had the rabbi on?
Yes, 2 weeks ago.
We had a rabbi on who is, I'm going to get the name wrong, but he does the equivalent of base synagogues. Mm-hmm. So he does synagogues out of his home. And
wonderful.
There are a few of them around the city because it appeals to a less structured, a less institutional brand of religion. I think he's got, what do you say, 300 in his community there?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, and I think 3,000 connected in a less less formal way. So I think, you know, I think you there may be something there. Okay, we're going to a break. Then we'll do a little news, and then we'll have our second guest on. And I'm delighted with our second guest, who is Dr. Minaz Afridi, who is an associate professor of religious studies at Manhattan College. And I'm going to twist Fred's arm to stay with us through our break and through our news notes. And we'll have a dialogue about Islam and with Professor Afridi about Ramadan and Lent. So join us when we come back in just a couple of minutes. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We continue during this Lenten time to talk about issues of spirituality, how they intersect with the world. And in a few minutes, we're going to speak with a professor of religious studies at Manhattan College, who's going to speak to us about Ramadan. And we're going to talk about Ramadan and Lent with Professor Afridi. And we're going to talk about how they are similar, how they are different. Just a little bit. I'm going to tease it a little bit. I got to tell you, I think there's a lot more similarities than there are differences, just from my knowledge. I probably know quite a bit more about Lent than I do about Ramadan. But from the little bit I know about Ramadan, I think there's a cross. So I encourage you, let's listen to what Professor Afridi has to say about that. Tom, what's in the news?
You know, Monsieur, that you had mentioned earlier in the show that we have a lot of holy things on the show today. And one thing that's kind of interesting is the tomb that Jesus' body is believed to have been interred in after he was crucified was just opened earlier this week. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem's Old City reopened. It went through about 9 months of renovation. The Greek scientists, they completed their nine-month renovation, and they focused on the small structure that's above the burial chamber. It's called the Edicule, which is above the cave where Jesus is supposed to have been buried. And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is in the heart of the Christian quarter, as you know, in the old walled city. And it is assumed to be the place of Jesus' burial and crucifixion and resurrection. It's a big attraction, and it's six denominations: the Roman Catholic Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, the Armenian Apostolic Church, Syrian Church, Ethiopian Orthodox Church, and the Copts all chair custodialship of the church.
Okay, so what did they do in the renovation? Do you know?
They actually went in, Monsieur, and they went into the tomb where actually Jesus, or the cave where Jesus' resurrection wound up taking place, and they restored the slab on which his body was anointed, because you know after as it was the practice of the Jews, they would wind up anointing the body. So they restored that had begun to decay a little bit, and then they also put in these I guess you could call them windows, or I guess places where you would be able to actually look in to the actual spot where the anointing of Jesus' body and the resurrection wind up taking place. So
Fred, have you been to the Holy Land?
No, unfortunately not. It's one of those journeys I've never managed to get to, and as the years grow short, I would still love to do it.
I think you should. I mean, I would say that I got a little goosebumpy when I kind of walked down into that underground place where the body of Jesus was laid. Pretty small. And it's a pretty, really eerie kind of feeling to kind of walk down in there. So it's good. So it's an interesting, you know, I'll tell you a little bit of a sad story, and it just shows how much we still have to go for in terms of faith and among Christians is, you know, the Christian denominations, the Christian churches who will share that place, they don't get along too well.
It's very sad. It really is.
It really is sad. And if you think it's not true, I'm going to tell you a fact is they are so bad that sometimes they wind up fighting with each other. Fist fights break out if somebody, their service goes 5 minutes longer. A fist fight can break out because the next group is supposed to come in. But they so don't trust each other that they think that somebody might lock them out from the church. So, in fact, none of the groups have a key.
Well, that's fascinating.
But there is a key.
Yeah.
There is a key. The key is held to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, arguably the holiest spot in all of Christendom, by a Muslim family.
Wow.
Because they trust the Muslims more than one another.
It says a great deal, doesn't it? And it's a very sad thing.
See how these Christians love one another.
One another. Yes.
I mean, and again, I would say, Fred, going back to our previous conversation, well, you know, there we might, those of us who do practice religion, who are part of religion, maybe sometimes we give people and the next generation's reasons to say, I don't have time for it, because some places we haven't gotten our act together, and this is just an example of it. You know, I think probably we have our act together more than some people give credit for, but we never should rest on our laurels, because there are still things we have to do in order to give better witness to the beliefs that we have.
And there is always time for love. That's what this program says, and that's the most basic truth of life, I think.
It is. I think, Fred, you're the professor, I'm not, but aren't there kind of two of those things, like those great commandments, that kind of say love's pretty important?
Yes, I think we've heard them.
Yeah.
And I think of the great Western religions all believe in them, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Yep. So, anyway, Tom, we got one more news item?
We do, Monsieur. You know, you were talking about trust and borders and such. Well, I mean, this week, the Trump administration put in its first request for the first $1 billion for funding for the border wall that they're looking to put up between the United States and Mexico. This $1 billion would cover about 62 miles of the border. Now, of course, the border with Mexico is almost or is over 1,900 miles, so it would only cover a fraction of what the border is.
Yeah, so it's you know, this is a topic that we've spoken about in the past, and we've spoken about this, and you know, our position is real simple. We think bridges are better than barriers. We think welcomes are better than walls, and we certainly, from our Catholic perspective, we do believe in border security. And if anybody says the Catholic Church doesn't believe in border security, they don't understand what our position is. We have a long-standing tradition that we believe in national sovereignty. We believe that a country has a right to control its borders. And we believe that there should be a generous immigration policy that comes in. We have no problem with the border being secured. We think it does need to be. We like things to be fact-based. And the fact base is that immigration from Mexico in the past 5 years has come to a trickle. And in some years, I think even more Mexicans were going back to Mexico than came in here. So we need a fact-based immigration policy, which is not slogan-driven. And so, yes, we should secure the border. But needing a wall, building a wall which symbolizes that we're not welcoming people, is not the right thing that we want to communicate. There are other ways to secure the border and do that. So why don't we take a break again, and when we come back, we'll speak with Professor Maynaz Afridi, Associate Professor at Manhattan College. And I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now I've been Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just love God, just love yourself, and just love your neighbor, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We talk about those things which are going on in the world, and we talk about them from our Catholic perspective. And right now, we're in the middle of our holy season of Lent. And part of what we've been doing during this holy season of Lent is trying to figure out what are the connections, what are the things we can learn from the other great religions of the world. And I got to tell you, I got a little bias. I got a bias towards the other religions that go back to Abraham. So I kind of think there's a little bit of a privileged place for the Jewish, Islamic faiths in how we compare that to Christianity. Not that there's anything wrong with any of the other ones, but we all go back to Abraham. So today I am just delighted that Dr. Minaz Afridi is taking the time to be with us. She's an associate professor of religious studies at Manhattan College, which is Tom Dobbins, who's in the studio here with us today. That's his alma mater, and she is the director of a center for the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education. Very, very profound areas that require a lot of thought and a lot of study. And I did manage to cajole our first guest, Dr. Fred Perella, who's a professor at Santa Clara University, to stay here. And he might kibitz a little bit with our next guest. So, Dr. Efferty, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored.
Well, so are we. So listen, for our listeners, tell us a little bit about Ramadan, just so we can set the stage and tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Actually, Ramadan happens to be my favorite month of the year as well.
Hey, but I got a question, Professor. I got a profession. Why can't you guys decide to keep it at the same time of the year? You keep moving it on me, so I never know when it is.
Well, I mean, you know, we had to learn, you know, something from the Jews, but we are on a lunar calendar. And
okay.
We keep shifting.
All right.
The hope of having Ramadan at some point in my life fall into winter is a really good positive outlook. So I'm looking forward to the shift.
Okay. Yeah. When is it this year?
So Ramadan actually technically means scorching heat or dryness.
Oh.
And it's the holy month where the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. And it's basically comes from the surah in the Quran 2:185, which talks about how the Quran was revealed. It's a time of fasting, and it's also a time of reflection and a proof of guidance in terms of the creation of rights and wrongs. And it's a time for self-purification, very much like Lent. In Lent, you know, you give up things and you focus on charity and justice. And they're very, very similar in terms of what the practice is about religiously and spiritually. So you have a self-purification. You also have not zakat. Zakat is a pillar, but you have sadaqah, which is really going beyond for charity, right? Or some people call it sadaqah. And so you see a lot of charity, a lot of giving, a lot of giving of food, a lot of giving of material goods, and also of social justice and service during the month. So you remember the poor, you unite, and you kind of keep yourself in check. So if you like coffee a lot, or if you smoke, or you have a bad habit, you kind of give it up for a month to make sure that you realize that these are all addictions, and your body should remain pure and clean.
Well, that's a great explanation, and it kind of leads me to, you know, what my hypothesis is, that, you know, there's far more in common among the great religions than people want to give the religions credit for. Obviously, there are great differences. But in some of the values, some of the practices, there's a common human core, which each of the great traditions kind of makes part of their very important practices.
Right.
So again, one of the things I've been trying to do this Lent is basically to say that, you know, I think in our Christian tradition, Lent has gotten a little bit of a bad name, and I don't think we've really understood as much, because we all kind of think of the fasting stuff and giving up stuff and all of those things. But basically, our strong tradition says kind of what you just said, that in our Christian tradition, it is about sacrifice or fasting from food or some other things. But it's also about more prayer, getting in touch with God more. And it is about almsgiving, charity, or service. So it's all of those things, because it's not just about giving up. There's a lot more to it than just kind of giving up stuff.
Right. And I mean, I think Lent and Ramadan are similar also, because, you know, Lent is 40 days, Ramadan is 30, and you kind of form a habit, you know. So if you form a habit of getting up really early and praying and reading the Quran, or you form a habit of, you know, of cleaning yourself or reflecting on God, you know, I think the hope is that it's going to filter throughout the whole year. I mean, that's the thing. It's not just the month, but the month carries forth. And then you read a lot of the Quran, and you have extra prayers at night if you can do it. For me, spiritually, what I've started to do, and this is on a personal note, is during Ramadan, I open up the Quran at any random page, and I start to read it. And I do that on purpose, because I feel like I find something new. And something different, and a different interpretation. Last Ramadan, I kept hitting on the chapter on Mary, right? The Virgin Mary.
Right.
Miriam. And so I discovered a lot of new things about, you know, who Miriam was and how we look at Miriam. And so it's kind of an exciting period of knowledge, too. Knowledge of one's own faith and stories around one's own faith. So it's not just about this, you know, physical and material, but it also has this very, very, I think, deep spiritual essence, where you are really kind of revisiting yourself.
So let me ask you this question, which, you know, you talk about opening randomly to a page there. Is there what we would call in our Christian tradition, is there a lectionary? So for us, there are assigned readings from the Bible for our liturgies for every day of the year. And the reason why that is, it's since the last 50 years, is precisely because they wanted to expose Catholics and Christians to a broader part of the Bible, rather than just only turning to the few passages that maybe people were familiar with. So now you get a whole set of readings that go through the whole year, and you get exposed to not the whole Bible, but a lot of it. Is there anything like that in Islam?
There is. I mean, you know, our Salat five times a day has specific surahs that we have to read, and they're universal. So I could go to any country, any Muslim country, and pray with them, because we are actually praying and saying the same words. So that's kind of the liturgy we have,
right,
in terms of prayer. And then during Ramadan, one is, you know, encouraged. It's not something that's farz, which means you have to do this. But you are encouraged to reread the Quran. So 30 days, 30 chapters. So, for example, my mother would read a chapter a day. So she finishes the Quran during Ramadan. I can't say I do that myself, because, you know, I have to go and teach and work and do all kinds of things.
Right.
But at this, you know, so there is, the liturgy lies within the Salat itself. And I think that's the beauty of the unity. So when you go to Hajj, or if you go to Jummah prayer, you know exactly what is going to happen and what you're saying. And all of these prayers are around the concept of the one God and the remembrance of God and Abraham's children. So it's repeated over and over again five times a day.
And so that's kind of the rhythm that one would get into. What I was, again, what I kind of was a little amazed at is, in our Catholic tradition, we would have what is called the Liturgy of the Hours. And while probably it's more appropriate to a monastic setting, it does get translated a little bit in that priests are supposed to say those prayers at the hours. It still is probably more appropriate in a monastic sentence. But You know, and there are parts of them, there's before dawn, there's at dawn, there's midday and evening and the night, and you can even do mid-morning and mid-afternoon. So it's kind of as a similar thing following the hours of the day.
Right, exactly, yeah. So you're and then the whole purpose of Salat, and it's, you know, people think it's a lot, but it's really very quick. You know, you spend 3 to 5 minutes. But you do it, and sometimes it becomes a habit. So, but then you start to say, okay, why am I leaving the room, or what is going on right now, or why is my alarm going on? And you're saying, oh, because I'm remembering God.
You know? Right.
It almost like comes, it jumps at you. So I think that's, or I'm thanking God, or something great happens and I must go pray, or something terrible happens and I must go pray. So there's all these different ways of dealing with remembering God all day, which is the form of dhikr, you know, taking God's name over and over again.
So I'll tell you, Professor, we're speaking with Professor Mehnaz Afridi, who is an associate professor of religious studies at Manhattan College, and she's the director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center at the college. So I'm going to tell you, I've been on a little bit of a kick in the past 2 years. And what I've said to people is, I think we Catholics now do a wimpy Lenten fast, because all we're required to do is to fast on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, so 2 days. And on the Fridays of Lent and Ash Wednesday, we're not supposed to eat meat. So I actually did a blog on this where I came up with this elaborate meal where you can have more food than you ever think of on a fast day, because our basic rule says you have one big meal and the other two meals shouldn't equal the one big meal. So if you have a super big meal, then you can have mini meals throughout the day. So I think it's pretty wimpy. That's my opinion, and I've actually told my boss that and all of that. So what I decided to do this year was to kind of, and I know I haven't gotten it all right, but to kind of do a modified fast that you would do during Ramadan. And and since I'm not so good at sunup, sunrise, I just said from 6 in the morning to 6 at night, I'm going to consider that daybreak and day thing. And the little modification, I said, I will do water during the day. But I figured that it was certainly much more than what we're required in Catholics. And it also got me to think more about solidarity with Islam. So that's what I'm trying for Lent this year.
Wow. And how's it going?
It's going well. It really is going. And I got to tell you that, you know, there are some middays and some stuff in the afternoon I don't want to get to the end of the day, because it's you know, your stomach begins to growl. And sometimes it gets me to think better of God, but sometimes for a few hours, I'm just thinking about how hungry I am, and I'm not thinking a lot about God.
Well, I mean, that's another, I mean, if I can
sure
talk about, you know, it's interesting because the first week is very hard.
Right.
And then the second week, you start to notice your body differently, and you start to be more aware of your physical contours. And that's another reason it's my favorite month,
yeah,
because I go through a lot of different things, and you start to be more aware of words in the page. The first week is kind of, oh, God, I'm hungry, or, you yeah know, how many days do I have left? But then by the second week, you're sort of used to it. And
yes,
almost towards the end, you're kind of like, oh, my God, that's it? It's over? So
yeah,
it's a weird process that you go through.
You know, Professor, you're absolutely right, but I hadn't thought about it until you brought it up. Fred, did you want to ask him?
Yes, Professor Afridi, Fred Perella. Do you think some of the millennial students that you and I teach are searching for something objective and structured that allow them to give something up? They seem to have everything available at all times, for the most part, without any kind of objective order that says there's a time for embracing and a time from refrain from embracing. Mm-hmm. I think that's a disturbing thing, and I wish that Lent and Ramadan would have a much greater impact on the broader culture, especially those students that we teach that don't have anything out there to help structure and say, this is what you need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting point, because you're right, everything is accessible, and I have kids too, so I completely understand what that's about. You know, an interesting thing, because I run the Holocaust Center, I also do classes on the Holocaust, and I take them to understand Judaism before we begin talking about the Holocaust. And one of the things we do is we go to Shabbat service. And I took them recently, about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and, you know, mainly my kids are Catholic or non-practicing, or a couple of Muslim students. And I told them that you can't use your phone, that Jews really kind of every week do not look at their phone for one whole day, which is Shabbat. And they were so intrigued by this.
Yeah. Yes.
And there were a couple of them that kind of were drawn by it and said, really, they don't use their iPhones? I said, no, they can't call. You know, they don't use any electronics. And they said, well, what do they do? And my response was, they reflect, they spend time with their family. They've already cooked their food, so they eat whatever they can. They go for walks. They read the Torah. You can read. Or, you know, they just go to the park and play. Okay. And they were just completely amused by this. And I think there's something to be said about Shabbat every week. And I've tried to take a Shabbat from my phone and my computer, not probably on you know, Saturday, but sometimes on Sunday. It doesn't, for me, I'm not Jewish. But I really like that concept.
Yes, I think that's a wonderful example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way I would probably look at this millennial student body. And there were a couple of them tried it. So I was really pleased.
Well, you know, again, Professor, one of the things where I say we've gotten into a wimpy Lent, what I've suggested to the congregation where I preach is that could they pick an hour a week in which they wouldn't use their social media? Because I think they'd go crazy if you said a whole day. So I was trying to give them something that was doable so that, and then maybe they could go a little bit longer than, I told them they couldn't do 3 o'clock in the morning either. It had to be a day that was there. But listen, we only have a minute or two less. Is there something you'd like to kind of add before we have to kind of sign off?
Sure. I mean, I want to thank you so much for bringing up, you know, the story of Ramadan, what Muslims do during Ramadan, because I think that's so needed today to hear about Muslim spiritual practices rather than, you know, the media and violence. And I think it's wonderful that, you know, Catholics are reaching out to Muslims, Muslims are reaching out to others, and I think that having this kind of a discussion about faith brings us all much closer.
Well, I want to thank you so much, and thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for taking the time to be with us on Just Love, and the best with your rest of your semester, and I hope that that your teaching goes well, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Professor Menaz Afridi, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan College, and we've been talking about Ramadan, and we've been talking about Millennials, when we're talking about Lent. I think there are a lot of intersections. I think there are a lot of things that, you know, we're not going to bring back in the way that we used to bring them back, but things are cyclic, and there are ways that we have to, you know, reach out, and we have to offer it. I mean, I do think that, you know, some of the things, even, you know, I worry sometimes, and yet I say, you know, when some of the forms of Catholicism, some communities, religious communities are growing, and sometimes they're not. So I'm delighted we had our conversation today. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.